Hi, this is Chrissy Anderson Peters, and I just wanted to give a little reading from my book, Blue Ridge Christmas, as a sort of Merry Christmas and Happy Holiday gift to all of you out there who have been so supportive and encouraging with my writing. Without further ado, I'm going to read the story, My People, from Blue Ridge Christmas. On November 28, 2016, devastating wildfires combined with abnormally high winds to create, quite literally, a perfect storm in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. In all, nearly 18,000 acres suffered fire damage. A total of 134 people were injured and 14 people died. When the winds picked up that night, confusion and chaos ensued. Residents and tourists called 911, asking if they should evacuate. Was there an actual emergency? The fires seemed to be closing in on homes and blocking roadways. Should people try to leave or stay put? Later, transcripts and tapes of many of those calls were made public, illustrating the complete lack of disaster preparedness. But who could have ever predicted something like this? Emergency services were cut off from entire segments of the area. Some people decided to flee their homes, sometimes with lethal repercussions. Evacuees sat in their cars in what quickly became a virtual parking lot on the one road out of the town of Gatlinburg, fires on all sides, unable to move forward, unable to go back, and unable to find any other way out. Approximately 1,000 families in Sevier County, Tennessee, completely lost their homes in the fires. Some had insurance, but most were without. It was the end of November and Thanksgiving had just passed. The weeks ahead looked bleak. No time was a good time, but the combination of the holidays, colder temperatures as winter set in, and the fact that the high tourism season was ended painted a dreary and desolate outlook. Any job still existing would be difficult to secure. One person stepped up to do what no one else, not even entire governmental agencies, would attempt. What no one imagined possible. But this woman knew all about imagination. Decades earlier, she had introduced a program promoting early childhood literacy in Sevier County. In the years since its inception, Imagination Library had grown to include all 50 states and four other countries. Dolly Parton devised a plan. Just hours after the devastation began, Dolly busily contacted her Dollywood Foundation's board members and lawyers, mobilizing troops to help her people recover. She announced a concert set for December 2nd to help raise funds for survivors who had, in essence, lost everything. The lineup crossed all musical genres and eras. It turned out that when Dolly Parton asked for help, people didn't say no. They just asked what they needed to do. Over $9 million was raised as a direct result of that concert. She pledged to help every single family who could prove residency in the county, whether citizenship was established or not, and who could provide evidence that their homes were structurally uninhabitable. She made sure that the whole world knew, however, that these funds were not to be considered a handout, but instead a hand up. The foundation created the system through which residents would apply for and receive $1,000 per month for 6 consecutive months to help them get back on their feet. The foundation, at that time, had only 13 employees worldwide. The work undertaken seemed immense, but the staff would forge ahead and help those who Dolly still calls my people. As I listened to the newscasts and watched the live internet feeds the night the fires began, I instinctively knew that I needed to help. I said to my husband, "I need to be there. I have to help." I'd just gone through 3 months of physical therapy for some shoulder issues. He looked at me in utter disbelief. "You can't go down there. They won't let you in. You're not part of emergency services. And you absolutely cannot volunteer and end up messing up that shoulder again." He made a valid point. Most volunteer efforts would almost certainly include lifting and moving emergency supplies. Still, I felt a force pulling me to go. When the My People Fund was announced, I seized my opportunity. I had been affiliated with the Imagination Library in my own area for years through my work as a librarian, so I sent an email to the foundation president. I don't know if you can use any help or if you guys have everything covered, but if there's something that I can do, I really want to. He pointed out that it would be a long commute for me, almost 2 hours each way. But if you want to help, just be here on Thursday morning at 8. The first month consisted of intaking applicants, verifying their claims, identities, etc. It would cover 4 days, each day set up alphabetically by surname. We would operate on Thursday, Friday, Monday, and Tuesday. Through lodging and eating locally, I reasoned that I would support the local economy and truly become a part of the greater community. I braved the cold December morning and headed for the doors of the LeConte Center. I honestly didn't know what to expect. I knew that I was there to help, but I also knew that this would likely be one of the most difficult things I'd ever faced. Once inside, I found Daniel, the foundation president, who greeted me warmly, thanked me for being there, and pointed me to Angel, the volunteer coordinator, one of her many functions within the foundation. Angel smiled, got me signed in, and looked around. Okay, you're going to be a door greeter. Kathy requested you. I was touched. Kathy was one of the two regional managers for the program. I'd only met her one time, more than a decade earlier. I was moved that she remembered me and had asked for me to be her partner at the doors. The setup inside the main room was mind-blowingly simple. 8 computer stations lined the exterior walls. Volunteers waited eagerly, anxiously to begin. So many smiling faces. I walked up to Kathy and said, Angel said that you requested me to help you. Kathy, who would become a tremendous friend and partner in mischief over the next few months, looked at me blankly. I did. I laughed, so much for my ego. On the first of many trips back to Angel's post, I stopped and looked outside. With over an hour until the doors would even open, the line already stretched beyond my line of vision. My heart pounded so hard. I was about to encounter people who had lost everything, sometimes so much more than anything materialistic. And my job was to smile, to welcome them, to do my best to help them. I watched out the front doors and saw a man walking up and down the line, handing out biscuits from some fast food restaurant. I bit my lip. How incredibly amazing was this community? Some random stranger had taken his time and money to come down and try to make the difficult process better. As the time approached to begin welcoming people, I looked around. Honestly, it was such a meager operation for such a massive undertaking. How could this possibly be anything but chaos? Just as I started to feel overwhelmed, Daniel called us all together to brief us on what we needed to do and how many people were estimated to come through our doors over the next few days. When those folks come in through those doors, don't just point them to a table and say, just go over to station 4. You walk them there. These folks have walked alone in this journey long enough. At least while they're here, we will walk with them. I looked over at Kathy. Both of us took a deep breath. The two of us would be the very first contact that people had when they walked through the doors. I had to be strong. Falling apart or succumbing to my own emotions was not an option. When the first applicants arrived, there was puzzlement. When they started to just walk to the open first computer station that was open, we took them by the arm or smiled invitingly and walked with them to the open stations. One man looked at me and shook his head. What is this? No one takes time like this to help people. I told him proudly that we did. And after that, throughout the duration of the program, I smiled. I asked people's names. I told them my name. This was more than walking people through a line. We were now in the realm of building relationships. We were truly there to assist them in whatever ways we could. I witnessed people wearing blankets around their shoulders or cradling dogs in their arms, hearing repeatedly the stories of how these were the only things they had left in the world. They had lost their homes, their clothes, and often their pets. All of the pictures and scrapbooks and family albums that had been passed down through their families for generations. Truly gut-wrenching experiences. One woman suddenly burst into tears and nearly fell to the floor sobbing as she walked in the doorway. I hugged her. It wasn't real until right now, she shook with tears. Until I got to this door, I could deny that any of this was happening. But I can't. It really happened. So many people, so many faces, names, and stories. What touched me and truly carried me through, though, especially those first couple of days, was the attitude of gratitude. If anyone in the world had a right to be bitter, to feel unfriendly and uncaring, these were the people. Yet nearly every horrific story was underscored with the same sentiment. But at least I'm still alive. It could be worse. The other prevalent sentiment was how thankful everyone was to Miss Dolly. Miss Dolly was more than a celebrity here. Miss Dolly was their patron saint. Tell Miss Dolly we said thank you so much. About an hour or so into the morning, a gentleman stood waiting his turn and shared his experience. I lost everything, even my Bible. I met a guy out on the parkway one day who was just handing them out for free, and I asked him for one. He gave it to me, and when I got home, I opened it up, looking for my favorite verses. And there, stuck between the pages, was a $100 bill. How about that, huh? He paused. What happened to me was bad. It was real bad. But God has just done so much already to help me. I'm lucky, really. I've had a few people, all strangers, just give me money when they found out what had happened. I feel guilty. I just know I need to share it. He produced a biscuit wrapper from his jacket pocket. I stopped by Hardee's for a biscuit this morning on my way here, and I thought, I can't stand in that big line of people with a biscuit when they don't have any. So I just told the lady at the window to give me 100 of them. My mouth fell open. You're the man who was handing out biscuits in the line a while ago. I thought it was someone who just stopped by to be nice. I swallowed hard. You, my friend, are an amazing individual. No wonder God keeps blessing you. It took less than 4 days for people to start scamming. A certain slumlord kept being called as individuals came in to verify who was living in the hotels at the time of the fires. After 3 or 4 calls, he offered to make them a list so they didn't have to keep calling. How nice. Over the next few days, we learned that he had made deals with associates. He gave them the necessary information to claim the $1,000 checks, and in return, he would receive a mere $200 from each of them. Each of them would pocket an easy $800, but he would collect $200 each from about 30 people for 6 months. The fallout was massive. A sign was posted stating that anyone who lived at one of those two addresses would be refused a check. If there were questions, they should contact their landlord. Several people, upon reaching that point in the line, looked around sheepishly and left. The problem with this, however, was that there was the remote possibility that some legitimate residents had not yet gone through the line. No one really thought about that at the time, though. The important part was that the bad guys had been stopped. On the final afternoon of month one, Kathy got food poisoning and left me to greet alone. The day was drawing to a close. My emotions were spent. The pain and suffering that I had encountered over those 4 days was truly palpable. I watched as a young lady, maybe 20 years old, stopped in front of that sign. She cocked her head and just kept looking at it, dazed. My first thought was that maybe she couldn't read, so I approached her with a smile and asked if I could help her. "I don't understand," she said. "I pre-registered online. I waited till the right day to come. What did I do wrong? I followed all the rules. The team leaders had very plainly and succinctly told us, no exceptions. Send anyone from either of these addresses away. I looked from her to the empty stations inside. Should I follow my gut? I can't promise anything, but let's see what we can do. I greeted the intake volunteer quickly and quietly. This young lady lives at one of the addresses on the signs. My counterpart looked at me with widened eyes and stated that I would need to get one of the team leaders. So I stepped through the door and found one of them. I explained the situation. Did you not understand? No exceptions? I did, but I think that she's legit. A few moments later, after talking with the team leader, she left in tears. My heart sank. I just knew. But a little while later, I looked up to see her again at the door. This isn't about me, she said firmly. I'm not here asking for money for me. This is for my baby, she declared determinedly. I looked at the letter in her hands, Department of Welfare. Again, I summoned a team leader. I respectfully refuse to tell someone that she cannot come in here because of her address. If you want to be the one to do that, then you can. Just then, another team member, Laurel, stopped in her tracks. What's going on? I told her the situation. She pursed her lips and thanked me. From the other side of the room, I held my breath, trying to read the situation as things played out. A couple of minutes later, Laura walked by with my young friend. As she did, she said, come on, sweetheart, let's go to the toy store we have set up to get that baby some Christmas presents. We'll give them a few minutes to do the right thing. Upon returning, they went back across the room. Excitedly, she hugged Laurel. She left tearfully. She got it. I stood silently and bit my lip. It's an amazing feeling when you realize that you have served a specific purpose. Completely humbling. I said my own prayer of thanks. If there was no other reason in the world for me to know so intuitively that I must be a part of the volunteer efforts here, then this was it. Someone else probably would have followed instructions. Someone else might have turned her away, regardless of her insistence. I tried to imagine what that must feel like, and I tried to be the kind of person who did the right thing. After all, these weren't just Ollie's people. They were my people, too. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful holiday season.